This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
The Open Championship in Sandwich, England, where the best of the world shows up to play at Royal St. George's. Day two is upon us. The weather is impeccable. The scoring is low. Colin Morikawa got it done in the early wave this morning, a 6-under 64 to take the lead at 9-under par. Emiliano Grillo also shot 64 today to get it to 6-under par. Other low rounds on the day include Daniel Van Tonder, never heard of him, who shot 66 to get to -6 for the tournament. Tony Finau with a 66 today. He's -4. Jordan Spieth right now -2 as he makes the turn. So that puts him at -7 for the tournament. Actually, he is now -8, so he birdied the 10th hole. He is through 10 holes. He has one shot. There we go. He is one shot off the lead, as is Louis Oosthuizen, who is now through 7 holes and is -8 as well. So it goes Colin Morikawa -9, Jordan Spieth and Louis Oosthuizen both tied for second at -8. So there are some very low rounds to be had out there. Unfortunately, Phil Mickelson was not able to realize those low rounds. Plus 12 for Phil Mickelson. He is going to obviously miss the cut. He is right now 152nd, solo. By the way, Will Zalatoris had to withdraw after an opening round 69 with back issues that he's dealing with.
Not nice.
So, listen, this is what happens at an Open Championship with no elements, because the greens are not fast there, and the reason they are not fast is because they keep them that way to account for the wind and the rain and whatever else you might encounter when you play an Open Championship. But when you get absolutely perfect weather, and I think there's some slight wind. I mean, they are right off the beach after all, but maybe just a zephyr of wind at Royal St. George's today. It is not hindering the players at all. You know, in some cases, it's actually weird that the slow greens, you know, the guys actually don't like them. They like them faster, generally speaking. And they can be a little bit tricky at first if you can't figure out how to putt them correctly, because they're so used to the lightning speed basically everywhere else they go. But with the conditions the way they are today, very little wind, clear skies, it is ripe for a scoring fest out there. One of the big stories that happened yesterday regarding Bryson DeChambeau, who is just like the rest of us, apparently, blaming his equipment. So, Dennis, before we go any further, let's play the audio for you from Bryson after the round yesterday, just to provide a little bit of context. Bryson, remember, shot 1-over par yesterday in his opening round. He hit 4 of 14 fairways, and here was a part of his post-round interview.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great, but again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks. It's not a good face for me, and we're still trying to figure out how to make it good on the miss hits. And you know, I'm living on the razor's edge, like I've told people for a long time. And you know, when I did get it outside of the fairway, like in the first cut and whatnot, I catch jumpers out of there, and I couldn't control my wedges. So it's quite finicky for me, because it's a golf course that's pretty short. And so when I hit driver up there and it doesn't necessarily go in the fairway, it's right in the first cut or whatever, it's tough for me to get it out onto the green and control that. It's literally the physics and the way that they build heads now. It's not the right design, unfortunately.
Well, when you are swinging at 200-plus miles an hour and you have a 5-degree driver, it's going to be very difficult for you to hit the ball accurately. So the reps for Puma Cobra had their issues with what Bryson said, obviously, because there are a lot of people that work behind the scenes with Bryson to try to make his equipment to spec. And shout out, by the way, to ESPN for this headline. I put this on Twitter. Quote, Bryson rips driver, apologizes after rep tees off. Mwah! Chef's kiss. Well done, little laddie, or lassie, whoever came up with that headline for Bryson and his problems. Bryson did end up apologizing for what he said yesterday after the round. He took to Instagram, because this is where the kids make all of their announcements and apologies. Quote, the comment I made in my post-round interview today was very unprofessional. My frustration and emotions over the way I drove the ball today boiled over. I sucked today, not my equipment. Cobra and I have worked together for over 5 years, and they are some of the hardest working people in golf industry and make an incredible product. Their team is like family to me, especially Ben Showman, who, by the way, was on the bag for Bryson a week or two ago when he split up with his regular caddy, Tim Tucker. Their team is like family to me, especially Ben Showman, who has been there for me every step of the way since I started my career. I deeply regret the words I used earlier. I am relentless in pursuit of improvement and perfection. Part of that causes me to become outwardly frustrated at times. With the new speeds I am obtaining, my game is a constant work in progress. So is controlling my emotions. I got a text from a buddy of mine a little bit ago who said, Bryson, and I wasn't really paying attention to a lot of the audio that was happening today as we were prepping for the show, had tournament on in the studio here, was trying to keep up with the action. But a buddy of mine texted me and said, Bryson just made some comment to the gallery on the tee just now to the effect of, it's okay, I know you all hate me. And really, how else are you supposed to handle this today?
Really? 100%?
I mean, you've just got to lean into the fact that you made a mistake and try to go out there and play some better golf. Where is Bryson DeChambeau today?
He's like plus four, I believe.
Is he plus four?
Or I know he was at least plus three.
Okay. I'm trying to look for him on the leaderboard.
Yeah, you're not going to find it. It's that far down.
Is he really? Yeah, he is. He's plus three. He's plus two on his round today. So things have not gotten better for Bryson DeChambeau today. He finished plus one. The cut right now is projected at plus one. So he's got some ground to make up. He does still have a bunch of golf left to play. He is, he's playing in the same group as Jordan Spieth. So they just made the turn. They just played the 10th hole. So we'll keep you updated on what happens with Bryson. Also, shout out to Justin Thomas on Twitter. Quote, never would have thought swinging at 135 plus miles per hour, it'd be hard to drive it straight. You'd think Mr. Physics would know that. Again. It's pretty simple, right? It's pretty simple. So Bryson DeChambeau in the news once again. But a hell of a golf tournament happening right now. Scores again are low. Colin Morikawa is in the lead at minus nine after a 64 today. All right, moving on. If you thought COVID was over, it definitely is not. Yankees Red Sox last night was supposed to be the first game after the All-Star game, postponed after six Yankees tested positive for COVID-19. Aaron Judge among the six players with positive tests. And the reason that that's significant is because of the All-Star game in which he played. And there are lots of other guys who played in the All-Star game and had to travel cross-country in order to get back to their teams to start the second half. Here is ESPN's Buster Olney, who discussed a little bit of the consternation surrounding big league players as it pertains to COVID-19 still and players that are rejoining their teams after the All-Star game.
The truth of it is that at that time, those affected were coaches. Right? There were no players at that time. This time, it's all players, and that potentially interrupts the Yankees season. And let's face it, from the Yankees' perspective, this is potentially devastating. If you're Brian Cashman, their general manager, if you're Aaron Boone, their manager, you're driving home last night thinking, we might be without our best player for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and things have already not been good for the Yankees this year. They've had a bad season, and this just makes bad worse. It's the eighth COVID-related postponement of the season. Possible doubleheader happening tonight. Not sure, that has not been announced just yet. The Yankees have exceeded the 85% vaccination rate. The majority of the six, we are told, who tested positive are vaccinated. There are a couple of them who aren't, one or two. And this is also the second outbreak of the season for the Yankees as well. So there is that in terms of COVID-19 still being a part of our lives, even though a lot of times it doesn't feel like that's the case. I saw that actually in Los Angeles, they're reinstating their mask mandates because of some of the increase in the Delta variant and cases rising and all of that kind of stuff. The other thing, too, as it pertains to sports, is Bradley Beal is going to be out. He is not, and this has been confirmed now by USA basketball officials, he is not going to make the trip to Tokyo for the Olympics. He was the second leading scorer in the NBA this year. And this was going to be his first Olympic team. And on top of that, the game against Australia has been canceled tonight. There was another exhibition game against for the USA basketball team tonight against Australia. That has been canceled. And then on top of that, not COVID-related, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN reporting that Kevin Love has now elected not to travel to Tokyo for the Olympic due to a right calf injury. So, that is basically what is going on in the news today. The other big story is Mark Emmert's sudden enlightenment. And for that, we welcome in for the second time this week our good friend from CBSSports.com, college sports writer and extraordinaire, Chip Patterson, joins us now here on the Adam Gold Show. Because, Chip, when I read the story about Mark Emmert talking about decentralizing and deregulating this version of college sports, my initial reaction was to search for the strategy behind these comments, to find out if there was anything nefarious or hypocritical happening here. But I'm not sure the reaction just shouldn't just be, well, this is great then. Welcome to the 21st century. Is there anything to be found behind these new revelations from Mark Emmert?
I mean, he's just the last person. He's the last person to officially say it. You know, you're sitting around. Everyone at the table knows that the power in college football doesn't lie with the NCAA. It's with the college football playoff. The power doesn't lie with the NCAA in college football. It's with these individual conferences. I mean, look at the way, even prior to name, image, and likeness, even prior to the Supreme Court case in the Alston case, the 9-0 ruling against the NCAA. But where was the NCAA when college football was trying to get started a year ago? When college football was trying to figure out what it was going to do, if it was going to be able to hold a season, and if you could hold a season, what needed to be in place? There's absolutely no involvement from the NCAA, and that is because the individual conferences, and then Mark Emmert said in his comments, the schools, they need to be the ones to make these decisions, because across the entire landscape, you know, tons of schools, if we're talking about all three divisions, but even at the Division I level, 330 some odd schools, they are not going to all have the exact same kinds of situations. So the same set of rules does not need to be in place that's going to apply to everybody across the stratosphere, even within Division I. And so by going hands off and being like, all right, conferences, y'all are in charge, it does look like the NCAA kind of quitting. But if we're going to talk about real power, like capital P power in college athletics, the individual conferences had already started to take that.
Chip, yeah, and Chip Patterson, CBSSports.com college sports writer, is joining us here. He says it's a time to rethink what college sports is all about. He also says that if we were going to build college sports again in 2020 instead of 1920, what would that look like? These are all questions that have been asked all of this time.
I know. Doesn't it seem like he's cherry picking the best arguments against him?
Yes.
Like he read all of the anti-NCAA columns with a highlighter and he highlighted his favorite parts. And then here he's like, and by the way, him taking this very public stance as he just had his contract extension approved, I imagine that he is now at the beginning of what will be a farewell tour of being a figurehead in college sports. That is my guess. I need to be very clear about that. But if I'm just to imagine Mark Emmert, who is already a university president at LSU, he was already a university president at the University of Washington. He's had this long run as the president of the NCAA that has had so many ups and downs, and you had to go through Supreme Court. I mean, Alec, if you were Mark Emmert, wouldn't you say that this is your last contract? And wouldn't you say, you know what? We're closing things down. We're shutting it down. I mean, he is really going to be able to cruise on this multi-million dollar salary for a couple more years and really not have a lot on his plate.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what they keep using this word decentralized. And I'm like, what about dissolution? I mean, what is that word in play here? Or is there still a need for some NCAA involvement in terms of what they do for, you know, events, you know, for the NCAA tournament, you know?
You hold championships. That's the NCAA's job is essentially as an event planner, organizer, and to run the championships because you do need the NCAA. The NCAA is ultimately just like the ACC. It just extends across the entire country, and we've all decided that the NCAA championship is what we're going to compete for. I mean, that's the difference between sports is an important part of this factor because you still do need the NCAA to organize and host and be the official arbiter of championships in so many sports that our favorite schools compete in. And like, especially here in the state of North Carolina are really, really good in. And so I do think that the NCAA really just wants to get out of the business of, enforcement and trying to get everybody to have, you know, the exact same set of rules for all of these sports at all these different levels. And maybe the NCAA does end up just being, like a major championship. our baseball group holds one event a year and the entire year is all about getting us ready for the College World Series and the baseball championships. Like, I think that it is a little bit more in that direction if I was to look into my crystal ball.
Chip Patterson from CBSSports.com. So this is essentially a waving of the white flag, is it not?
Yeah. Well, from an enforcement standpoint and from a breaking the rules. And so let's go ahead and spin this forward because
What's it look like then?
Well, Tennessee fired Jeremy Pruitt. And part of the cause that Tennessee used to fire its football coach was allegations of NCAA recruiting violations. And those NCAA recruiting violations, you know, I'll take you one step into the weeds. The call came from inside the house. Somebody essentially told on everybody else about what was going on because SEC schools don't tell on each other anymore. And that's why they're so good at football. The other example is Arizona State. Arizona State's a little more tricky because they were blatantly not following COVID guidelines in the middle of a pandemic. Like, that's going to cut a little bit different than some basic recruiting violations. But with the NCAA's public statements, how, if I'm a Tennessee fan, if I'm an Arizona State fan, you know, if I've got any kind of like NCAA penalties potentially coming down the line, I am much less afraid of what that might look like just because there's no way the NCAA can have these kind of comments from its president and these kind of actions over the last several weeks and then turn around with the same kind of hammer that they dropped on USC and Reggie Bush a little over a decade ago.
Chip Patterson, CBSSports.com. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you for helping me understand that there really is nothing behind all of this. Have a good one.
Hey, Spieth gets it to 10 before he's out of here. What do you think?
I do think so. I mean, he just made the turn at 3 under par. And he's just driven it on the 12th hole. It looks like in the fairway, avoiding a bunker. So yeah, I'm gonna say yes. He gets it to 10 under par. Could be his week. Yeah, how about did Rory make the cut? By the way, he's right on the cut line. He was +1.
Rory, I believe, will make the cut.
He missed a birdie putt on the 18th hole to get him to even par.
+1 will still get you in. I feel pretty good about that. I was just trying to see if my guy Mark Leishman was going to be able to get through, but I don't think that's going to be the case. He's at plus two. I needed more bogeys, but the problem is the scoring conditions are great. Normally, I love the late early play. Last group out on Thursday, first group out on Friday. I like the momentum behind it, but for this particular tournament, the scoring average has actually been better with the early Thursday, late Friday. Like you mentioned earlier on the show, a little bit of wind, but man, you can go out and get it right now. Mm. So I think the plus ones are all safe just because there's so many of them looking at the cut line right now. But Rory will make it through the weekend. But I did not imagine that at a championship where I thought the winner was going to be six under for the tournament, that we'd be talking about a cut line of plus one.
Man, I'd be terrible as a late early guy. I'm more of an early late guy. I'd prefer
you
that.
You like to have the long time in between. I like to keep the momentum going. It's like the last thing you thought about before you go into bed, wake up, get back after it, and then you get to relax until your tea time on Saturday if you played well enough.
Nah, it's about sleep for me. I can't. Okay. I have too hard of a time getting out of the bed. Like it's the hardest part of my day.
You made it today, and you're doing great.
Chip Patterson, CBSSports.com. Thanks, man. I appreciate you.
Sounds good. Y'all be well.
All right. Yeah, I was in bed last night, and I saw these comments from Mark Emmert. The time is right to consider a decentralized and deregulated version of college sports, shifting power to conferences and campuses and reconsidering how schools are aligned, asking questions and making statements that we have been saying for what feels like decades at this point. DJ for birdie. He is now minus four.
That was about a back-to-back birdies for Dustin Johnson. That was about like a 25-footer, I'd say.
I mean, DJ should be good here. He shouldn't really have to pull the driver out a whole lot if he can hit it accurately. I mean, he's the best player in the world, or one of the top two players in the world. He should be fine. Anyways, Mark Emmert using statements like embracing players that are using college sports as a path to pro sports. Yeah. Yeah, we should. Can't treat field hockey the way we treat football. You think? How do we welcome Mark Emmert into the 21st century? Just applause? Do we throw him a party? Like, do we bring him to a millennials, club situation?
Take him to a brewery.
Yeah, do we take him to a brewery?
Take him to a brewery and a food truck. Yeah. Welcome to the 21st
century.
That's
a good question. How should we welcome Mark Emmert into the 21st century?
I don't think the joy of that 2016 championship will ever go away for Cubs fans. You know that. You're married to a Cubs fan. But there's no doubt about it. In 20 years, as one member of that team told me last week, you will have players on this team look back and ask the question, why didn't we accomplish more? Why didn't we win another championship? Why didn't we get close again? And it's something that I think is going to hang over these players as they move on into retirement.
Because you forgot how to hit. That's why. Nobody remembered how to hit a baseball after 2016. It's Buster Olney from ESPN. Welcome back to the Adam Gold Show. Alec Campbell here, Cub fan. Dennis Cox is producing. We're at the halfway mark of the Major League Baseball season, about to get underway in the second half. And to help me talk about what's going to happen in the second half, it's time to welcome on Darren Vaught, USA Baseball play-by-play voice. High point. What do we got? Jordan Spieth
with a birdie.
Jordan Spieth has made five birdies on the day, one bogey. He is now nine under par, which is tied for a share of the lead. All right, back to baseball. Darren Vaught, USA Baseball, High Point Basketball voice, ESPN Plus. You've heard him on this radio network before. Follow him on Twitter, at Darren Vaught, Major League Baseball aficionado. All right, Darren, I'm assuming you heard Buster's comments there about the Cubs, and actually I was going to ask you about that because the Cubs did win a World Series in 2016, but how are we going to remember this Cubs run over the last six or so years now that the sell-off has actually already started with Jock Peterson getting traded last night, even though he wasn't really a part of any of those teams?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question, criticism, when it comes to the Cubs. Why weren't they able to accomplish more? Because I heard you allude to the fact that they just couldn't hit after the year 2016. I mean, massive drop-offs for guys like Kyle Schwarber, who's no longer a Cub,
had
to completely reconstruct his swing. And now, you know, he's had this resurgence, right, with the Washington Nationals. Chris Bryant dropped off after what was an MVP season, one of very few MLB players ever to follow up a Rookie of the Year campaign with an MVP award, which he did in 15 and 16. And now he's sort of back to at least close to where he was during his MVP run. But yeah, no, it's just, I think, to be honest with you, again, it's a fair question, a fair criticism, but the weight that was on their shoulders just from getting the one is enough. So in terms of how they'll be remembered, I'm not sure that it's much of a disappointment. They got the one, and I'm not a Cubs fan, so I can't claim to you know, feel the way that they feel or know how they feel exactly. But I would assume that most are, for the most part, perfectly happy with the run that this recent vintage of Cubs gave them, because again, it got them the one, and that's all they needed. And now, you know, they had this hot start to the season. That's the real disappointment, is that they fell off after beginning the season on a really, really good note and turning into kind of what we probably would have expected them to become. I don't know that I would have expected them to become such hard sellers with Jock Peterson out the door so quickly. He had an amazing spring for them. But, you know, the Braves will now try to use him to fill a little bit of that Ronald Acuna void after his injury.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one ended up being sort of a convenient thing just because Ronald Acuna got injured, and the Cubs were obvious sellers. They had basically told everybody that they were open for business, and that need came up. Jock's been pretty good for the Cubs this year, I would say, as a regular outfielder. He'll play corner spots probably for the Atlanta Braves, and that was a need they had to get for a team that's, you know, a contender, I would think. All right, so how would Chris Bryant look in a Mets uniform? Because I'm seeing his name ballyhooed about as one of the guys, you know, the Mets are one of the teams that I'm seeing. John Heyman was reporting this, that is interested in Chris Bryant.
Yeah, and they were interested even prior to their dealing for Francisco Lindor in the offseason. Bryant was one of the names that was floated around with, I mean, you know, everybody that was floated around for the Mets, even Trevor Bauer as a free agent possibility and those sort of things. And they ended up, even before his recent hangups, they ended up on the right side with not acquiring Bauer for a massive, massive contract, because Taijuan Walker has been maybe the sneakiest great pickup of the offseason. He's been tremendous and got the replacement sub into the All-Star game, making his first All-Star game with the Mets. To your question about Chris Bryant, particularly, did you see their announcement yesterday, the Mets? They're bringing back the black uniforms with the orange drop shadow and everything. I think Bryant would look tremendous in one of those, but I also believe everyone would look good in one of those uniforms. I think Bryant's a great fit there. He's a great fit in a number of places because he can play a number of positions. He's a, you know, corner infielder, corner outfielder, if you really need him to do that.
Yeah.
He's, again, back to his solid hitting ways. And the funny thing about the Braves, you mentioned the Braves, the NL East is wild, man, because no one in that division feels like the Mets have separated themselves enough. So even with the injury to Ronald Acuna Jr., the Braves are going after it, right? They're trying to get back as much of that production as possible. They go out and get Jock Peterson. So the Mets are going to have to answer with some of these moves, because they've struggled hitting at times as well. The pitching has been great, but as it normally is the case, you know, DeGrom will throw you a gem of a quality start and get zero or one run of support. And that's just how it goes. And it's sort of trickled down to guys like Taijuan and Marcus Stroman, who's had a really good year for them as well on the mound. So I think going after Chris Bryant is probable for the Mets. Again, they liked him in free agents, or not free agency, in the offseason as a trade possibility. And I think it would just shore up their lineup even more And he's a guy that, again, with the Cubs as the sellers that they are, it kind of makes sense. And the Cubs got a good prospect from the Braves out of Jock Peterson, the Braves' number 12 prospect, Bryce Ball, who's a good infielder and should probably get called up at some point for the Cubs, maybe even this season. Who knows? So they could get a good return on Bryant as well. I think it would make sense for both sides.
Darren Vaught joining us from USA Baseball. I want to get to the things that USA Baseball is doing here in the coming days here in just a minute or two. You mentioned the Mets, +9 in run differential. There's a lot of ways to skin the cat. If you ain't going to score a lot of runs, you should prevent runs. And that's basically what the Mets do. But I want to go out west to the National League West. The San Francisco Giants lead that division. The Dodgers are two games behind. The Padres, we know what kind of star power they have in their lineup. How for real are the San Francisco Giants?
I was hesitant to call them for real toward the beginning of the season, much like I was the Boston Red Sox. But now at 57-32, two games ahead of the Dodgers, six games ahead of the Padres, it's inarguable. The Giants are here, man. They are at this point. Their playoff odds are something like 99%. They're going to be there. And what's amazing about what they've done is they're doing it with veteran guys who, a lot like the Cubs hitters we were talking about, have not been good the past several seasons and are sort of back to their old ways. Evan Longoria got off to such a hot start. He's got 9 home runs and, you know, currently on the injured list. But Brandon Crawford has been really, really productive for them at shortstop. Mike Yastrzemski, obviously, is a newer piece to their lineup, although not necessarily young at 30 years old. But he's productive, as he has been in his first couple of years in the league. And, you know, then they get some solid contributions from a guy like outfielder Darren or first baseman Darren Ruff off of the bench, who's been solid with a near 400 on base percentage. And the pitching's been there, too. Buster Posey, by the way, probably the biggest bounce back for them. Again, somebody who's on the injured list, and they're faring these injuries pretty well, to be honest, because they've had a fair number of them. But Posey, man, taking that year off in 2020, but between he and Ryan Zimmerman, I don't know that I'm happier to see somebody hit a home run on a regular basis in Major League Baseball, because they both took the years off in 2020, both at relatively advanced ages for being Major League Baseball players. Posey at 34 has, 12 home runs this season. He's driven in 28. I mean, very, very solid at the plate for the Giants, and you know, an OPS nearing 1,000. They're for real, man. It's a fun collection of talent. And, of course, you know, local people would note that Sky Bolt, former UNC star, recently made his debut and has been up and down with the Giants too. So that's a fun name to keep track of. And they'll probably need and use him down the stretch a little bit as well.
And then over to the American League as Darren Vaught joins us here. The Houston Astros lead the AL West. Are folks going to be able to handle it if they make another run this year? And of the three teams that lead their division in the American League, the Boston Red Sox, the Chicago White Sox, and the Houston Astros, who do you like best?
I have long been on the I'm not as upset with the Astros as everybody else is.
Same. Thank you. I'm an ally. You have an ally.
It's so hard for me to get emotionally invested or upset in the Astros when we have stories like Eric Kratz coming out and publicly saying, yeah, the Rockies were doing it in 2010. The Rockies.
Right.
In 2010. Did the Rockies win a championship in 2010? Were the Rockies of note in 2010? No. So, I mean, it's fair to say that with Kratz's coming out and telling that and other accounts from guys, that it's mostly been a pervasive thing. Mm-hmm. And they're going to shut down on it like they have. And the waters are going to level, so it's all the same. Now, I don't love the way certain Astros players handled it in the fallout, but, you know, to me, I think they're even more likable now because Dusty Baker's on board, and I don't know that there's a cooler human being on planet Earth. So it's tough for me to to speak for the majority when it comes to the Astros, but I would imagine some people are going to have issue if they make a deep run, or some people are just not going to be as interested if it's the Astros that make a deep run. I like them as compared to the other teams. I like them because they've been there before. The Astros are tried and true. Jose Altuve has bounced back nicely from his abysmal 2020 season. And with that in mind, too, I think you can, for me personally, Alec, I am able to write off very quickly if a player had a bad 2020. The circumstances that were there, I mean, it's nothing for me to see somebody who really, really struggled in 2020. JD Martinez is the same way for the Boston Red Sox, and he's been tremendous again this year, back to his solid ways. So I'm still maybe just a little hesitant on the Red Sox. I like the Astros to be there just because they're solid top to bottom, and they have been, and the scandal from their championship season really doesn't change that for me. And Dusty Baker is a good manager and navigates personalities as well as anybody ahead of a Major League Baseball team there is.
Darren Vaught joining us. We've got about 60 seconds left. I want to get to what you're doing with Team USA Baseball as the play-by-play voice and what they're doing, maybe more importantly, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Olympic team versus USA collegiate team at the DBAP one of those days. What do we need to know about those games coming up?
Yeah, so the collegiate national team just finished its summer tour of the Appalachian League towns, and they played Stars versus Stripes games. So it was 48 of the best players in all of college baseball, headed up by NC State's Elliot Avent, the collegiate national team manager. Now that they have completed that series, they're paring down to a roster that's going to match up with Team USA that we are sending to Tokyo. And over the next few days, the 18th, 19th, and 20th, they'll be at the National Training Complex in Cary on the 18th and 20th at 6:30 and then 1 p.m. on the 20th. But on the 19th, 6:35 start at the DBAP. So for this series, I joked with Dennis, it's Mike Socha versus Elliot Avent,
nice,
if you will. Mike Socha, the three-time World Series champion, the manager of our Olympic team. So come check it out. Come to the National Training Complex and check those out. And if you want to catch the game at the DBAP, tickets available at DurhamBulls.com.
Darren Vaught, play-by-play voice, USA Baseball, High Point Basketball, ESPN+. Plus. He's all over the place. Follow him on Twitter, at Darren Vaught. Darren, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate you taking a couple of minutes out today on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. I really appreciate the time. Alec, tell me one thing. Am I going to have good news with Dougie Hamilton? Good news being that I want him to stay with the Canes? No?
I am pessimistic. I am pessimistic,
okay,
on that,
right,
front. So let go.
That's
just
fair.
Go ahead and set yourself. Just mentally prepare for Dougie Hamilton not being here. That's what I would say.
That's fine.
Just fine. So that if it
mostly
happens,
the other things that I wanted, they've happened.
This,
so I can sacrifice one, I guess.
This way, if he stays, you'll be pleasantly surprised, and if he goes, you won't hit the ground too hard.
That's a good approach to most things. Low expectations. There we go.
All right, Darren. Thanks, man. Have a good one. All right, BG, before we get to tomorrow night's game, I need to go back, because you'll appreciate this. You love these types of takes. We need to go back to game four. Do you remember that Giannis had a big-time block at the end of the game in game four?
I do remember that. Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
It was a cool block, right?
It was.
Yeah, it was really cool. Max Kellerman, how cool was that block?
He's stopping Devin Booker from penetrating. Mm-hmm. He's preventing penetration, and then also blocking the alley-oop to DeAndre Ayton. Right, two pretty good players to be guarding at the same time in the finals, a pivotal game four. If you lose that game, and it looks like it's coming down to the wire, you're going to lose the series down 3-1. If you win, you might win the series. So, considering the skill, athletic ability, everything that goes into that play, and the high leverage moment, that's one of the greatest plays in the history of basketball.
All right. Listen, to be honest with you, I would need to go back through time and list all of the greatest plays before I decided whether or not I thought that was the greatest play in all of basketball. So I'm not even going to say Max is wrong here, but where does that play rank in the history of basketball?
Well, first off, that was the only thing that was said on First Take this week. Definitely nothing else was said on that show this week that was deemed perhaps offensive right. in some way, shape, or form. But yeah, no, shout out to Max Kellerman for entering into the multiverse to go back through all the all of the history of basketball yeah. to make sure that he had sort of done his research. Like, jokes aside, it was an amazing play.
It was.
I don't think it's LeBron blocking Iguodala in 2016, just like considering the stakes of that moment, of that series, of that player. But it is like next to it, you know, at least in recent memory, you know, in my sort of like lifetime of watching basketball, it was incredible. And Giannis really has just been like in general, outside of just sort of Milwaukee getting back into the series and tying it up. How Giannis has played the last three games, man, is just totally ridiculous on both sides of the court. It was an incredible play. It really was.
Yeah, it was, because he basically defended the screener and the roller on the same play, which is insane to do, especially against a guy in Ayton who's taller than he is.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's the – when we're talking about guys that can guard pick and roll as the big guy in the action – like, if you're not switching, which the Bucks do a lot with Giannis, right? Like, he was very good switching out onto Chris Paul in game four, too, to show his versatility. But when the big guy drops on those screens, right? Like, his DeAndre Ayton goes up, sets a screen, and it's up to the Giannis or the guy guarding the screener to be able to drop and be in that middle area, right? To be able to be in two places at one time. And to guard the ball handler and to contest a floater or a layup or to make sure that shot isn't available. And at the same time, be able to defend against the lob back to the rolling big player. And Giannis did it perfectly at, you know, the absolute, you know, the highest leverage moment you could probably imagine, at least up to this point of his career. It was incredible.
Brian Geisinger, League Pass Lair, HTSports.com, joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. All right, one other thing real quick before I get to Phoenix. Charles Barkley said a couple weeks ago that he would fine Giannis every time he took a first quarter three-pointer. Are you in the camp, because he's not the only person that I've heard say this. Are you in the camp that Giannis shouldn't shoot threes, or that he should, because the mere threat of Giannis shooting threes is helpful to him?
So, I don't think he... Look, he can do whatever he wants, and the way I think about it is this, is that if I, like, I don't think he should be shooting threes, but if like, he wants to get up one or two or three of them a game, if that's, like, the price of admission to get him rampaging down the lane, you know, every other time he touches the ball, like, if I'm Mike Budenholzer, I live with it, right?
Right.
It is important to remember, even if he made two in a row, the defense is still not going to change how they guard him. Like right. You know, they're going to invite him to continue shooting shots from out there. if they're not going to change, I mean, he would have to have, you know, a year of making that shot for teams to actually react to it. So it's not changing how teams cover. It's not bending the defense. It's not doing any of these things to sort of like create advantage, which he does basically every other time he touches the basketball in transition or in the half court. I mean, he's basically playing like Shaq, you know, inside the paint. He was 13 of 13 at the rim in game three. So, yeah, why would you shoot a three? Would you make, you know, like 30% of the time when you're wide open at absolute best? Like, the numbers don't bear it out. He doesn't look very comfortable doing it. The defense is not going to respect it. It's not gaining you any advantage. But if he wants to do it, and that is what gets him to also drive to the rim 50 times per game and draw fouls and dunk on the opponent, then, like, you know, I'll live with it. But it really does feel like just an absolute punt on a couple of possessions for the Bucks in a game, in a series where the margins are very tight. But, of course, Milwaukee is also cleaning up on the offensive glass, so maybe it's not even a punt when he does take those threes.
Write this down. BG agrees with Charles Barkley. Put that somewhere. Right. Log that so we can go back to that at some point.
That's right.
Brian Geisker from accsports.com is joining us here. All right, since you kind of led me here with Giannis, you know, getting downhill and going to the hoop and all of those things, I presented this to Brendan yesterday because there's a part of me that takes issue with all the anti-charge people. And not that I don't understand their argument, that sometimes it's, you know, just lazy defense for someone that can just slide over and, yeah, you know, put themselves in position to make a play when they weren't there. Now, I'll be honest. I choose to view that as drawing a foul, just like you draw a foul any other time in a game, right? We applaud everyone who goes up and draws fouls offensively. But then when someone uses the advantages or uses the rules to their advantages defensively in the block charge situation, we're suddenly incensed that that's a call, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was a scenario on, what was it, Wednesday night now, where Giannis is at the top of the key and no one's really coming out to defend him. DeAndre Ayton steps right above the semicircle. And Giannis says, okay, I guess I'm going to go to the hole because no one's taking me on. And so DeAndre Ayton did what all the anti-charge people want him to do, and that is move his feet and try to play defense. And he got a foul called on him. I thought a little bit of a ticky-tack scenario in terms of the foul that he got called on. But if he's going to get called on that, how the hell are you supposed to guard Giannis?
Yeah, you really can't. I mean, foul him, but like that's not good either, especially when it's DeAndre Ayton. And like Phoenix basically has to minutes match Ayton with Giannis as much as they possibly can. In this series, yeah, in the finals, Giannis, by the way, is shooting 88% at the rim. He's 35 of 40 at the rim. You know, I don't know what you're supposed to do. And in game four, the officiating was just like bad. They were letting him play to start, then they stopped, then at the end they were letting them play again. It was not well officiated.
No.
But that's, you know, neither was really game three with Scott Foster pulling the strings. So I don't know. It's just like how these things go, I guess. But you know, I don't know what you're supposed to do. I am of, and this is a broader conversation that we don't really have time to get into, but in both college and the NBA, I would be fine with more no calls on the, like, when a guy's in the air and the defensive player slides underneath him, you know, or he's about to get in the air and the defender slides over at the last second and they call that a charge. I'd be fine with calling those more of a no call just to sort of like disincentivize it a little bit, because I do think those plays are dangerous. I don't think it's really like in the spirit of the rule either, but, that's not always the case either, but that is part of like something that is something on all levels of basketball. I would be interested in sort of like altering the way it's officiated, but we've just turned it into another way to protect the rim. Basically it is to be able to just dive bomb outside of the restricted area and try to like camp out there and pick up charges.
Yeah.
But so like, again, sometimes it's great defense and we need to applaud that. Sometimes the play, it feels a little cheap, and it feels dangerous to the offensive player.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I understand the arguments that people make against it. And, you know, people would say, well, you need to move your feet better and play better defense, you know, yeah, is basically what their argument would be. And I'm not necessarily opposed to that either. And we also know that the block charge call has to be one of the most inconsistently called things in all of sports.
Yes. Yeah.
But we also can't have the ability for someone to just – this isn't football. You can't just barrel over somebody on your way to the basket at the same time, right?
Yes.
So there has to be something there to prevent that from happening to some extent. All right.
I agree, but like that's in the spirit of the rule. That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's like the help defender, the off-ball defender sliding over when there was a clear path and then getting underneath it. That's the right one that I feel a little iffy about.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Brian Geisker, accsports.com, League Pass Lair, is joining us here. Follow him on Twitter at @bgeis_board. All right, over to the Phoenix side. Where is it as simple as you've got to get Devin Booker and Chris Paul playing well at the same time for them to get back on track? Or is there more of an adjustment that Phoenix can make? to try to win game five?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question because Phoenix, while this is a really, really good team and Chris Paul's an all-time great player and Devin Booker is a star, you know, they're both probably top 20, top 30 guys in the league. You know, they're somewhere in that range, maybe top 15 for Booker, but it's close. And you, on the opposite side, you got a guy like Giannis, who is in the conversation for best player in the world, and right now probably has that crown. From a recency bias point of view, at least, he's playing so well here on this stage. So yeah, Phoenix has to have either both of those guys going at the same time, or one of them's got to be in supernova mode, like Booker was the other night. But even then, when that happens, the other guy still has to give you some sort of baseline of production. Mm-hmm. And it's a bummer. You've known me for a long time. You know how fond I am of Chris Paul, how much I love his game. If Chris Paul has an average game, I'm talking about not even a standout game, not even a notable game, even if he shoots as poorly as he did the other night, which was just 5 of 13, he missed both of his threes, didn't get to the free throw line. All of that would have been fine if not for the handful of turnovers that he had too. And yep. A couple ones that were really, really bad. We'll all remember the one at the end where he sort of slipped and it lost the ball and it Middleton scores on the other end, basically ends the game. But he had a couple passes to just nowhere earlier in the game. And he doesn't do that. He's short circuited a couple of times. The supercomputer in his brain just kind of spasmed out a few times in this game. And yeah, if he doesn't do that, despite Giannis's brilliance, despite Chris Middleton putting up 40 points in an NBA Finals game, Phoenix wins on the road and they're going back home 3-1 up tomorrow, to close out tomorrow night. That's how tight the margins are right now. And I do think someone like Jrue Holiday is giving him fits, and I think that's causing ripple effects all over Phoenix's offense. Holiday's picking him up 94 feet, right? As soon as they inbound the ball, Jrue Holiday's there. And not like Jrue Holiday's going to steal it from him in the backcourt, but it's taking Phoenix longer to get into their offense, right? Mm-hmm. And then I feel like once Chris does clear half court and they get set up into their half court, not only are they later into the shot clock than they normally would be by a couple of seconds, which matters. The possession's going down in time. It's becoming increasingly less efficient as every second ticks away. But I also feel like they're rushing into the first shot they get because they're like, oh, we may not get another one back. And so because that's leading Chris to force a pass or whatever. Again, we can live with the missed shots because it's basketball. It's make or miss. Sometimes you're going to have games where stuff rattles out. And he did. He had a couple shots lip out in that game. But it's the turnovers and it's what Holiday's point of attack defense is causing to the rest of Phoenix's offense, of which Paul is the key initiator for. That's having a pretty serious impact on the last two games, but especially game four.
Brian Geisiger, League Pass Lair, is joining us here. All right, last thing for you, and this actually does not pertain to the NBA Finals, but I'm seeing reports here, at least from Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports, that Damian Lillard has or plans to officially request a trade from the Portland Trailblazers. What's your reaction to a non-Trailblazer, Damian Lillard Trailblazer team?
Whew, well, changes everything. And, depending on the package that they would get back for him, it would probably launch a full rebuild. Assuming they just got young picks and they got picks and young players back, the next step would be trade CJ McCollum. But so basically the last decade of Blazers basketball would, you'd be completely turning it over. And you kind of have to an extent because Terry Stotts is gone now and he'd been there for a while. But Damian Lillard, if he isn't the greatest Portland Trailblazer of all time, he's right up there. I mean, I think he's the best, but you also have, Drexler, you've got Bill Walton, et cetera. But Lillard's resume speaks for itself. He's one of the, top 10, 12 players, 15 players in the world. He's incredible. Anywhere he goes, he's going to turn that offense, up a couple of notches. And yeah, he is one of the best players in recent NBA history. And he's 30, 31 years old. So he's sort of at the end. He's staring down some opportunities to, maybe get on an actual title team. So it would be a bummer because I pull for small markets as a guy that follows the Hornets and, you know, had to see Charlotte lose Kemba a couple years ago. And I don't think the NBA makes it easy on these teams to keep these guys. Small markets are at a disadvantage, like Portland. And so, yeah, that would make – it would bum me out because I've stayed up way too late, way too many nights over the last decade of my life watching the Blazers play on League Pass because it was a good excuse to watch Damian Lillard go bonkers against somebody. But, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge was the bridge post-Brandon Roy, and Damian Lillard was the bridge. You know, he teamed up with Aldridge. They were teammates for a couple of years, and he was the bridge after that. Got him to a Western Conference Finals 2 years ago. That's nothing to sneeze at. Pretty impressive. But if he goes – you burn it all down, and you start back over. It turns into a rebuilding effort in Portland because all of a sudden their actual window to compete is completely altered, depending on – really depends on the trade package. But my guess would be that it would be the end of an era and the start of something new in Portland, which is probably not what Chauncey Billups thought he was signing up for a couple of weeks ago.
All right, one last thing for Brian Geisinger. Actually, two more things for Brian Geisinger, League Pass, LarryHCSports.com. No Bradley Beal. No Kevin Love for Team USA Basketball. They have been replaced, according to Shams Charania of The Athletic, by Keldon Johnson and JaVale McGee.
Yeah, yeah.
What should people know about these two players?
Well, Keldon Johnson's a really good young player. He just finished the second season. He plays for the Spurs, like a power wing, one and done at Kentucky. You may remember him from the first game that Zion and RJ Barrett and Cam Reddish played in at Duke was against Kentucky. That Kentucky team that ended up being really, really good had PJ Washington, Tyler Herro, Keldon Johnson, but Duke blew the doors off of them. Keldon's turned into a really nice player, and he might be part of like San Antonio's young core going forward. It sort of depends on what direction they want to go in. It's weird to see him on this type of roster. Like, you know, it really seemed like Team USA was trying to reload with a veteran-laden roster this year, and everything's just gone sideways. But Keldon Johnson can play. He's really good. You could play him at a bunch of different positions on the international stage. JaVale McGee, like, yeah, I mean, I don't really know, like, what we're doing. Like, I like JaVale. He helped those Warriors teams. He helped the Lakers win a title last year. He's turned into, like, a suitable backup center in the NBA. And I know that they're down a lot of options right now, but it's good for him, and hopefully he can go win a gold medal. But yeah, I don't like, it's weird. This is kind of a mess with Team USA right now. I do wonder if Miles Bridges and PJ Washington from the Charlotte Hornets, like if those guys hadn't gotten put into the COVID protocols last week, I do wonder if maybe one of those guys would have gotten the call up to this roster. But apparently Keldon played well as part of the select team at the training camp, so I'm happy for that. But Team USA, this is kind of a mess right now. Some bad losses, COVID issues, guys dropping out. It's not really a good look currently.
All right, last thing for you, Brian. When it's all said and done, who will be the GOAT of Space Jam? LeBron or Jordan?
This is an important question, and I'm glad we're having the discussion. You know, you're passing up Bugs Bunny. You're not even.
Oh, that's right. That's true.
Right.
So yeah, many other stars.
He's like, you know, we always forget about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the GOAT debate when we're talking. It always comes down to LeBron and Michael,
yeah.
MJ and LeBron. And we forget about Kareem. Just like we're just this Bugs Bunny erasure here. It's just not, I can't stand for it. But I will say, I'll say Michael Jordan because the original, how can you not go with that? But I don't know, man. I feel like everyone's clowning on this movie, but like, it's also not for you and me.
Yeah, right, right.
does the 6 year old, you know, like, you know, if you have a niece or a nephew, like, do they like this movie? Like, that's who it's for.
Oh, that's the barometer for sure.
You know, so yeah. I think people are like clowning it online or whatever, saying like why, you know, this movie is going to be bad or whatever. And it's like, ultimately, it's just funny to see like 37-year-olds having like very like frank conversations about Space Jam 2.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, this movie is for kids, guys. Chill out.
It is, except 37-year-olds are me. And when the original Space Jam came out, we were 12. Yeah, so this this is the nostalgic piece that it hits. But basically what you've said, what you just told me, is that Jordan blazed his own trail with Space Jam, and LeBron's just glomming on to Space Jam championships.
That's right. Yes, that's true. That's exactly what I'm saying.
What a sellout.
Yeah, seriously.
Go make your own cartoon movie, LeBron.
Have to join a super team. We need emergency episodes of First Take to really just rip into this right now. We do.
Brian Geisinger, ACCSports.com, League Pass Lair. Thanks so much, my man. I always appreciate you. Enjoy the Open Championship this weekend.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do. Yeah, be good, guys.
All right, later, man.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast. Part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.